Cine Marathon, the movie marathons podcast where we watch movie marathons all in one day and talk about them later. Last time we left off talking about the James Bond movies. If you missed part one, go back and check that out. But now here is part two.
You only live twice, or so it seems.
The next movie was You Only Live Twice, which really was a really good one, in my opinion.
It's my favorite Connery.
This is the one where you finally see Blofeld for the first time.
Yeah.
And they have the big dome fight. And it's the one where he turns Japanese for like some reason.
Oh, Japanese
like,
Bond.
And it was written by Roald Dahl, too.
Oh, yeah.
He wrote the screenplay, which is bizarre, but like kind of cool.
Awesome gyrocopter fight.
Yes.
that might be one of my favorite Bond vehicles. That thing was awesome.
It hauled ass. Yeah. I was not expecting a little thing that came out of six briefcases to fly that fast.
Yeah, and actually the person that was flying it for the scenes was actually the inventor of it.
Oh,
like,
really?
He came out and flew it because at the time he was the only one proficient enough in flying it. He logged the most
they
hours.
They just died. I think this is one of the first ones where they... I mean, I guess in Thunderball they go to Nassau or whatever. But this, to me, felt like the first, like, we've done James Bond in all these places, so let's take him to, like, a foreign country.
Yeah.
And this is now, like, the Japanese Bond. Like, everything's the same, except now he's in Japan.
And actually, in the opening sequence, we feature the first portable MI6 headquarters with, like,
submarine.
The total, like, mimicking of Moneypenny's office.
Complete
like,
with coat rack.
Everything is the exact same as it was in the building, but now it's in submarine form.
And then later in Terminator Salvation, I guess they took that over and... That's what the guys are working on in that horrible movie. Anyway. So when they're in Japan, they go to a ninja school. But, like, all the ninjas are just, like, screaming their heads off.
Yeah.
It's like, welcome to my secret spy ninja school. Wow! Like, and they just were in no way, like, stealthy.
Yeah. Not to mention the fact that they're outside in a field. It's like, if this is your secret spy school, maybe do it underground or indoors.
Totally.
My only argument to that would be, a ninja school, which is, you see all the stuff going on. But when they go underground to the underground part of the school, that's the secret stuff. Because now he's got ninjas training with guns, training
to
be marksmen, working with weapons and gadgets.
So the people upstairs are screaming as a distraction.
No, it's part of the training. People get trained to be in the martial arts in Japan. That's why it's Japan.
And then Bond starts banging Japanese chicks, right? Like,
oh, yeah, right.
That's where he backs his
cocky
station.
Bond.
Is this his first, like, multicultural...
A lot of the previous Bond girls are ambiguously ethnic.
Non-white.
Yeah.
I think so. Oh, no, you know what? I totally take that back. In Dr. No, there's like an Asian lady. The one that...
Yeah, the one whose house he lives in.
Yeah, one of his first ones.
But it seems like his relationship with the girl that he's with at the beginning of this film is kind of a serious one. Like, has
is
conversations
this the one
with,
he gets, like, fake married to? Or?
It's the one before that.
It's when he's still training, like, when the assassin comes in to try to kill Bond.
When the
Bond.
String comes down
from
the ceiling.
Right.
And she bites the bullet on that.
Oh, yes.
Mm.
And then she's fake marrying
and
this
then,
other
one. Yeah,
she
replacement
poisoned,
girl.
Right?
Yeah, they just replace her with another, like, Asian girl.
Yeah, because the guy's like, you got to get fake married. And he's like, can I pick who I get fake married to? Because he's got this girl that he's been hanging out with. And he's like, no, you have to marry this pig-faced woman or something.
Well, he had to marry a girl from the island that they were going to be hanging out
with.
Right.
And that's when he goes into yellow face, I guess is what they call it. Like,
they just combed his hair forward and
so
brushed his
convincing.
Eyebrows out.
They're just like making like bowls full of dye to dye his skin.
He's the hairiest Japanese man ever.
Yeah, for sure.
With a Scottish accent.
He just looked like Sean Connery with like a bad haircut.
Yeah,
definitely.
Like, they had eye prosthetics, but like...
Yeah,
you're telling me they didn't replace Connery with a Japanese guy?
No. He was actually just wearing the mask from Russia.
Oh, gosh.
I vividly remember from this movie the finale with the whole, like, missile silo, like, people coming in on ropes and shit.
Oh, man, that is one of the best sequences of the entire series.
That's one of the most amazing sets of, like, the franchise, for me.
Yeah.
Like, I thought
and it was, like, to scale, right?
Yeah, the hole in the ceiling, which really opened and closed, was big enough to land a helicopter in.
And they did, right?
Like, they had, so I had to have enough room to maneuver, come in, and land. At that time, that's a pretty impressive feat.
It's impressive now because that would just be
still
CG today.
Yeah. Oh,
like, you wouldn't even try and build something
garbage.
That big.
That lair was so big that I didn't grasp how big it was until, like, the movie was almost over and they actually did ring in the helicopter. Yeah. And I was like, holy shit.
In the Simpsons episode with, like, Scorpio.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It so directly is this lair.
Yeah, when they're coming down on the ropes.
Yeah.
And,
like, literally, it's the same place.
Yeah.
And they finally show us Blofeld.
Donald Pleasance. Oh, that's the Donald Pleasance Blofeld.
Who I honestly like best Blofeld. Best one first.
Yeah. I think he's the best Blofeld. Max, he definitely beats Max von Sydow. From Never Say Never.
That scar is what makes him for me.
Yeah,
he's
that awesome scar.
Yeah, it's basically the Dr. Evil face is the Blofeld.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
And it's totally modeled after, like, even specifically Pleasance. I wouldn't even say that it's a Telly Savalas face.
He's got the Dr. No costume, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I remember, Pat, you told me some awesome trivia about the cat in this movie that needs to be mentioned.
It's totally freaking out for the whole last scene. Because alarms are going off and people are firing blanks everywhere. So this cat is just flipping out. And Donald Pleasance is holding onto it like it's purring. And it's you can tell it's deep into his arm with its claws and everything. And he calmly walks off out of shot. And apparently immediately drops the cat afterwards because it's tearing into his arm.
Wow. Yeah, the terror in this cat's face.
But it looks like almost like a robot cat in this scene when it's freaking out. It looks almost not even like an animal.
Yeah, and Donald Pleasance is 100% calm. He shows no sign of reaction. It's really amazing.
The dude took on Michael Myers. He can take a cat.
Yeah, someone might as well be slashing his face open with glass. Yeah. And actually, this is the first where we see his face, but previously we'd seen him only from behind, and he's played by the same actor that plays Dr. No in both of those appearances.
Oh, yeah.
Really?
But I kind of wonder if that's why Blofeld dresses like Dr. No does, because he was played by Dr. No the first couple times, and so he already had the same, like, collared shirts and everything.
Right. It's a Spectre uniform.
They were like, is it a Spectre uniform?
Probably.
There's a lot of...
Because nobody else wears them.
A lot of Neighbor jackets in the Bond series. Yeah. Like, Neighbor suits, it's like every bad guy just gets... I think the guy in, like, Moonraker has one. Mm-hmm. And, like,
one of my other favorite things about this was the self-destruct. You know, this is like the classic Bond villain last move when the villain's escaping. How do you build a base and then go, okay, so this is a support beam. Let's wrap it in dynamite. We're all going to wire this all to this one lever
for safety
over here.
Yeah, it's interesting how in old movies they would build in like a self-destruct and it made sense that everything blew up. But like in later movies, they still need this like super cliche, like the whole place is blowing up, but like they don't necessarily have like a self-destruct.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So there's always
that's just like the go-to action movie finish, though,
I guess.
Yeah,
right.
You assume that there's explosives everywhere.
Someone drops a cigarette and it's assumed that the whole place is blowing up.
Can we credit the Bond franchise with that cliche idea?
Because they brought that in pretty early. Certainly, I would say a lot of movie cliches come from the Bond series.
Because that's what happens is you take out the villain, and then sometimes you got to take out the one henchman afterward, and then it's about escaping the building before it explodes.
Yeah.
And like
all of the Sean Connery movies, with the exception of one, end with him in a raft.
Yeah, everything except for one movie ends with him in a raft.
It's always at sea, and at maybe minus one, it's Connery in a raft making out with some chick.
Well, you know, there's a deleted scene in Austin Powers
where they're on the raft. Yeah.
That's right.
The scene's actually, I watched, it's horrible, and it's like, there's a good-ass reason it got cut, and they made a new ending. But, like, the joke itself is kind of funny. I think the place blows up, and then they're just magically
in a raft.
Yeah.
Brings us to On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Which is my favorite Bond theme.
I agree with you as well. This is pretty awesome.
Yes. It's in my top three.
The one and only good thing. No, I'm kidding.
It's not the typical Bond theme. It's a totally new score, and it's really, really good, and I love it.
But On Her Majesty's Secret Service was not one of our favorite movies of the night.
No.
Pretty rough.
Sir Hillary can kiss my ass.
He was the most inefficient Bond.
Yeah, this is not George Lazenby takes over as Bond.
Which I think going into this film, we had all had some understanding of what Honor Majesty's Secret Service was. We had some sort of memory of it.
I felt like we were even looking forward to his performance.
I think we were too, because George Lazenby historically gets a very bad rap as being like the worst Bond or a terrible Bond.
And we were sure it was undeserved.
Yeah, we were like, no way, Lazenby knocked it out of the park.
He looks like a good Bond.
He looks like Sean Connery.
It's only because, yes, exactly, he looks like Sean Connery.
Yeah.
But upon repeat viewing, all of our expectations were shattered, and we realized that Lazenby gets all that shit because he deserves it.
Yeah.
He is a terrible
person. Well, the highlight of your film is a curling scene.
Yeah.
I think this is one of those cases where, like, on its own, like, if you're like, today I'm going to watch a Bond movie, and you just throw that movie in, you're like, oh, okay, this isn't so bad. But, like, in a marathon with all the other Bond movies to compare it to, like, it just did not stack up.
I agree.
Save maybe, like, the ending, which I think is probably the best part of the movie. I know we were a little, like, polarized on that one. But
wait, what
specifically? So in the movie, George Lazenby as Bond marries Diana Rigg?
Like, oh, yes. Right. Not
so
until the end, yeah.
There's this weird-ass plot where, like, this guy's going to pay Bond to, like, marry this girl, and that's his secret fucking mission for some reason.
Yeah.
And so he ends up marrying Diana Rigg, and then at the end of the movie, it's, like, Blofeld and this lady drive by, blow away the car, and Diana Rigg's dead, and it's this really bummer ending, which to me is the only good thing in the movie. It's sort of this change of pace of, like, we have this sort of sad ending, and he tried to marry a girl, and now she's dead. And, like,
yeah.
And it is a subject that will be brought up several times later in the series.
Yeah.
They will mention the fact that he got married, and this is also the first time we see, like, the Bond family motto, which is, the world is not enough.
Yes.
Which will become the title of a movie
that's
later.
Right. Like, there's good ideas in there. I think just a lot of it is, as compared to Connery, I mean, this is the first guy that takes over Bond after Connery, who's, like, so iconic as Bond, and he just does not have that charm. I remember in the opening's actually kind of all right. Like, he fights this guy on the beach, and it's all great, but then there's this really stupid part where he looks at the camera, and he's like, this never happened to the other fellow, like, winky-wink.
Oh, right.
Like,
yeah,
breaking the fourth wall.
He just looks right at the camera. To me, it's such a bad move on their part. To literally, I mean, I guess
it's like a slap in the face to the continuity of it.
Well, to me, it's more like, I mean, I guess they're feeling, oh, they need to address it or something. But to me, they're better served just sort of, like, getting on with it.
Yeah.
Like, don't remind us that this guy's not Bond. Like, it just made it feel
we figured it out.
Yeah. To me, it just made it more clear, like, this guy ain't Bond. He does not have the goods. He's great Sir Hillary.
Up until then, he was a good Bond. Like, that, because that whole fight scene, like, I was into that. I was like, that's badass. And then that happened, and that chick got in his car and stole it for all of 20 feet to get into her own car and drive away.
Right.
Like, but up until that point, he was a good Bond, and then from there, it just went downhill.
Yeah, I think it was interesting that Peter Hunt, the director, was previously an editor on the other Bond movies.
On all of them.
And all these movies are pretty close to 2 hours, if not longer, which made the marathon, like, that's what made it so epic.
Oh, yeah.
But even him being an editor, coming from a director standpoint, he didn't make the movie with editing in mind. Like, there's a good 40 or 50 minutes of movie that could be taken out.
I don't know if that's fair to say. I think a better way to say it would be that because he didn't edit this movie, I think the problem was basically that Peter Hunt wasn't cutting the movie anymore.
Because
honestly, I think it could have been an okay movie if they had cut more stuff out. It was overshot for safety's sake, and that's what an editor would do, is shoot way too much footage, but this new editor didn't know and just used all of it.
But, I mean, I think the ultimate downfall is, like, the main plot involves Bond going undercover and not being Bond. I think the first time Bond's ever used an alias, and probably last. Like, every other movie, he just walks into the
Bond. Well, he got married.
Yeah, when he got...
When he was Japanese Bond.
Yeah, all right.
And in From Russia with Love, he also had...
Yeah.
But, I mean, those were flimsy covers.
I don't think he ever actually introduced himself as that. It was just kind of like, this is your name. Tell it to the guy, like, taking tickets on the train, because that matters.
Well, how did he think he was fooling Blofeld, who's seen him?
Yeah,
who knows?
We fought.
Well, technically,
it
was a different guy. Maybe Blofeld just didn't.
But
know
in canon, in the universe of Bond, Blofeld and Bond have come face to face. Like, they know what each other look like.
Yeah, but they replaced Blofeld's face with Telly Savalas' face.
Because
he changes his face every 5 years.
That's right.
Yeah, but he knows what Bond looks like.
Yeah.
No, like, Bond changed his face too.
And I thought Telly Savalas was kind of a lackluster Blofeld.
Yeah.
Like, he's okay.
I didn't think he really really fit into the franchise even. Like, yeah. He feels more like a war movie guy to me because I've only seen him in war movies.
He should
movies.
Be pimping Diners Club cards. And
he's at Bullfell and he's got the lollipop in his mouth.
Who loves you, baby?
I was reading that when they originally cast Sean Connery, Ian Fleming was like, no, he's Scottish, it doesn't work. And so he had written into this book, the book for Honor Majesty's Secret Service, that Bond was going to explain that he was from Scotland. Or that he was raised in Scotland after being born in England. Huh. And so there was all this information. And then when the movie finally came along, you have an Australian guy playing James Bond. But for
on.
The whole movie, he's wearing a kilt. Oh, and he's man. Supposed to be like this English secret agent wearing a kilt, but he's Australian. And he's wow. talking with a retarded accent.
Yeah, so actually Bond, now within the universe, is Scottish. That's like,
yeah.
it's been
his heritage
his
is Scottish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
His family heritage is Scottish because Ian Fleming liked Sean Connery so much.
And because for some reason this movie spends about 40 minutes talking about like, genealogy in like the most boring drawn out scenes.
Yeah, that sucked.
I'm giving this a low point for the Bond girls
yes.
too. Curly McGee just wasn't.
Hey, well,
which is
right.
ridiculous because there are so many of them.
Well,
like,
this is also what's so strange is like Diana Rigg actually in like the Avengers is like pretty
yeah.
hot.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I can understand the casting, like, it makes sense, but I think the problem is, like, they didn't put her in, like, a tight leather Catwoman outfit and make her look like
No, but
awesome.
I think they also went the other direction. They dressed her specifically unattractive.
Yeah.
So that it's not like, oh, he just married another whore that he was with. It's like, no, he married this, like, respectable woman because she's dressed ugly.
That her father bribed him to
paid
try
him
to
yeah.
be with.
Yeah.
Right. Another thing that I really didn't like about this was the part where Lazenby is climbing up the interior workings of the ski lift, trying to, like, come down. It takes him, like, 3 failed attempts before he finally does it correctly. And that's just not Bond to me.
The editor was confused, and he used all 3 takes of the scene.
Yeah, exactly.
He just put them in,
yeah.
in a row.
Because, again, they didn't have the normal editor.
Yeah.
If you're an editor, like, you should know.
Yeah.
That guy gets an F.
One of my biggest problems with it was, like, with a James Bond movie, normally, I should be so distracted by the action that I'm not looking for plot holes and continuity issues. In this film, and I'm all for this, it becomes a mainstay in the series of people skiing downhill, and then there's shootouts going on, and there's fights. And some of Lazenby's best hits are in this downhill skiing scene.
Yeah.
So he skis all the way down the hill, and then he meets up with the woman that he was paid to date for a while, and she just happens to be in town, and so they hang out for a while. And then, next scene, he's back at the top of the hill, skiing back down the hill. Why did he go back up the hill? We don't know, but he's already in a chase with Blofeld and henchmen.
Again.
And it just makes no sense that...
Maybe they were mid-hill?
But, I mean, like, at least make some kind of a
it's
reference.
It's a big mountain. It's Everest, apparently.
But, but then why did Blofeld come halfway down to meet him? All they had to do was say, oh, I gotta go back up because I left my keys or some shit. And they don't bother to explain why he's suddenly back at the top of the hill. Not to mention that the villain's plan in this movie is to develop like super food allergies.
Yeah, he's got like a slew of ladies.
Like a harem
yeah.
of allergy prone.
It's like, remember when you were gonna blow up the world in the last movie and now you're like, I got an idea for my cat. I started sneezing. I'm gonna
yeah,
give
like
everyone food allergies.
It's like psychiatry with the women or something.
Yeah, he like mind
brainwashes.
Yeah,
he like brainwashes them.
And he's also got some kind of weird plan where he's trying to prove his genealogy to take control of some kind of family dowry or something.
I don't
like
even
he like that's
that.
Like the whole point is like that he's trying to prove that he's like the heir to this family fortune.
Oh, right, which is because of his earlobes, right?
Yeah.
Like, well, it was the genealogy. They had like no lower earlobes or something. Like he had them surgically removed. Or
yeah,
that was the fucking Bond movie.
And honestly, the best part of the movie for me is when Lazenby's on the curling thing and he goes and slides across the ground with a gun and he's firing at people while he's sliding along the ice.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Which
yeah.
it turns out was Hunt's idea on set. Like the director was just like, why don't we have a scene where he slides down the ice and shoots at people?
Cool.
And it's like, so the best part of the movie was not in the script.
Diamonds are forever. Hold one up and then caress it.
Well, that brings us to, well, technically not Connery's last Bond movie, but certainly his last official Bond movie for the run of it. Diamonds Are Forever. Man, what an opening, huh? Like,
Yes.
Yes.
Matthew, what was your impression?
I learned that violence against women can be hilarious. Even, although still wrong.
Can be.
But our sincerest apologies to the one woman listening to this podcast about James Bond. We're so
I'm not
sorry.
Condoning it. I'm just saying it makes you laugh sometimes. But no, there's a scene where Bond goes up to a woman and he needs information. And instead of just, I don't know, choking her with his hand, which I think seemed to have worked.
That would have been the polite thing to do.
That would have been the polite thing to do. In broad daylight, he goes up to her and says, I've wanted to get something off your chest. Proceeds to undo her bikini top and then strangle her.
In one fell swoop.
Yes.
Which
in like half a second, just...
Yeah, he's obviously done it before, because you're not that good at something like that without practice.
Right. There was actually an episode of The Pickup Artist about that. It's a common movie.
Now, to clarify, he's after Blofeld, because he killed his wife,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
So he's not just... like a mad boss and strangler. Like, he's, like, on the hunt for Blofeld.
I believe he would have done it anyway. But
he was stopping by for a visit. Hey, nice to see you.
But it's just a perfect... It's, like, the culmination of all of the violence against women that Sean Connery has, like, perpetrated throughout these films. Like,
yeah.
Like this is his last Bond movie, and he needed to go out on top with something really great.
Wow.
And that was the moment. Like, we were dying. Like, it's so funny. But
is he going after Blofeld at the beginning of
the movie? Yeah, because it's not just this woman. He goes to, like, a slew of dudes.
Yeah, there's men in there, too.
And it's all like, where's Blofeld? Like, he's just after
him. Because my answer, if I was her, would have been like, didn't Telly Savalas get choked by a tree to death in the last movie? I thought he died. And...
No. Because, he seemingly dies. Yeah. But at the very end of the movie, him and the woman he was working with drive by in a car and do like
okay, I forgot he was in the car.
Like
I thought it was just her.
Drive-by shooting.
Yeah, Capone style.
Yeah.
Did he really care for his wife?
He did.
Yes.
Because in the movie, he fell in love with her and it was like legit. Like,
that's,
he was like giving
that's
up
very
the game.
Anti-Bond.
Because, it kind of threw me off because I thought, because he's been kind of a douche and like an asshole when it comes to women, like I just assumed that he was marrying her for the money. But
well, he even at the end of the movie is like, the guy offers the money and he's like, oh, don't even worry about it, like
oh right.
No, he refuses the money, like
he's sincerely in love with her. I mean, the rage that exists in the opening of Diamonds Forever is justified, in at least like characteristically, like it's not against,
but it's so weird that like Connery's back.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So it didn't even happen to him, but he's like so pissed.
But I think that's the only way that, like, honestly, if Connery was in on Her Majesty's Secret Service, that it wouldn't have happened that way. For some reason, Lazenby's like super polite to everybody and he's just smiling and he's really nice and he just doesn't want to hurt anybody's feelings and every girl is just beautiful and he wants to marry them all. And it just doesn't make any sense. It's not James Bond. It's like James Bond's brother.
Yeah.
And then Sean Connery comes like back to his senses, like he just woke up from hypnosis in the last movie. And he's like, what? I had a wife? Why did I have... I must have cared a lot about her then. I'm going to kill people.
Yeah.
That opening gambit ends with Bond picking up Blofeld, who's in like a wheelchair or some sort of scooter thing.
No. That's
no?
later.
That's much later.
No.
Sorry.
This, he does find him. And it's Charles Gray is playing him, and he was actually in You Only Live Twice. He got killed like right North by Northwest style. Like, he just got stabbed in the back. But now he's back as Blofeld, seemingly Blofeld, that he throws into like a mud pit. But later in the movie, it's revealed like there's a lot of plastic surgery going on, and he's like Saddam Hussein. There's like Blofeld doubles and stuff. But
like, considering the time that's passed between each of these movies, like Blofeld's got a... He's got a lot of stuff going at the same time, you know. He's got, I got my volcano base, but I'm also working on this food allergy thing. And then over here, I got some clones and a satellite.
But yeah, I mean, I'd say aside from the opening of Diamonds Forever, honestly, like, the rest of the movie's just kind of like, okay, meh, like, in my opinion.
Yeah, yes. It's the great blah experience. Yeah.
Starts off great. I thought the Bond girl, like, Jill St. John or whatever, like, was officially, like, this is where they dropped the ball.
Really?
On Bond girls. I did not like her as a Bond
girl. As a character or visually?
Just all around. Visually, she's fine.
I thought she was very attractive.
No. She's an attractive woman.
Well, there are very few ugly Bond girls.
Like, I don't know. It just... She didn't feel like a Bond girl to me. Like, she's real goofy.
She felt annoying to me.
To me, it just didn't do it for me. But it's not that she's not pretty. It's like... I remember her character being just very comical and like always like putting tapes in her like butt and stuff like put.
She's the one with the cassette in her.
She's wearing a bikini like constantly.
I like that the plan was that no one will recognize the square object in her butt.
Well, that
like,
was no, the like, plan.
No, the plan was that they would notice.
Yeah, they would recognize it.
Yeah,
and they would actually. Yeah, so that way they would crush the actual tape.
Oh, gosh. And
play that false one.
This movie also, speaking of Bond girls, has plenty of O'Toole in it, which is awesome just because of her
best name and shortest like appearance.
Yeah, she
best name?
Well, not, I mean, very funny. I'd say funniest name.
I actually, that was the thing that I liked the least about her. Because Plenty O'Toole sounds like a dude to me.
I think it's pretty awesome that she was thrown topless out of a window of a hotel.
Yeah.
Like, he lands in a swimming pool and Bond's all... tells the henchman, nice shot. And the guy looks out the window. I didn't know there was a pool down there. It's like,
did greatly enjoy, like, not even closeted, like, openly gay, like, bad guys.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Mr. Kid and Mr.
They were just holding each other's hands.
That movie.
I mean, they didn't kiss or anything, but they would, like, so clearly.
They held hands.
Frolicking like, along the desert. Yeah.
And the one guy was always, like, spraying himself with perfume, and that's how Bond was able to recognize who it was.
Yeah. Not because they're gay. But they're also very creepy. Like, how they look.
Oh, yeah.
Like, just very,
Crosby. One of them looks like Crosby.
Yeah, one of them looks like Crosby. Like,
Stills
totally.
And Nash. Yeah.
Also, about Plenty O'Toole, I guess they almost drown her. Because there was another scene that was supposed to take place down at the pool. But when they were shooting that scene, they had it so that she could move her head up and take a breath every once in a while. But because the pool was slanted, as most pools are, the weight was sliding toward the deep end, and they almost drown her, which,
man.
I mean, it was actually played by Lana Wood, Natalie Wood's younger sister.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Holy cow.
So it would have been extra crazy. Especially creepy for both of their daughters to have passed away so young. But I put her in my top five, even though she was kind of, like, naggy as far as Bond girls go, because she was, like, super cute. This is also the one that has, like, the man on fire ending, right? The explosive in the...
Yes.
Oh, right.
Oh, yeah. We have to mention how one of the bad guys goes out in this movie.
It's one of those, like, henchmen show up after the fact situations, and they try and attack James Bond with grenades on the balcony of his cruise ship.
And they basically shove a bomb up the dude's ass and then throw him overboard.
And he does, like, an Olympic diver's, like, spin.
Yeah.
Like,
before his ass blows up.
Yeah.
And that's like another big cliche where like you think the movie's over and then some henchman comes in posing as a waiter or like whatever, like ready to kill him.
The bomb was hidden in a cake.
Yeah.
And they were so clearly like murderers. I'd be so sketched out if those dudes came in my hotel room.
Or I would just be like trying to think of which Crosby, Stills, Nash sign I wanted to hear.
Yeah.
And then this was the movie with, I think it was at Circus Circus, where like they go into a tent and a woman becomes like a gorilla.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Was that this one?
Yeah,
that was this one.
It's like this huge like black woman just becomes like, it's like a magic trick.
No, she wasn't huge at all. She was just
Just like really. Well,
she was just skinny.
Not huge as in like large. Like as in tall, I think.
Yeah, it's like tall, very fit, very like Amazonian style woman. And she, is one of the few black women we see in any of the movies so far, and they turn her into a gorilla, which is... although, even if it is unintentional, just on the verge.
I don't know how that's
unintentional.
Like, honestly, like, that had to be just plain racism, because I don't know what else you could possibly interpret that.
But this is the same movie with, like, Bambi and Thumper.
Yeah.
Oh, that's true.
Thumper was a black... I think they technically refer to her as, like, the first black Bond girl.
Like
even though she didn't kiss him or anything, but she's technically like she's all sexied up and like fighting him.
Yeah, and he tries to drown.
That's
her.
One where he drowns both of them.
Yeah, he drowns both of them.
I like the plot element though, you know, because they make like one of the characters, Willard White, he's like this Howard Hughes kind of recluse, and Blofeld has pretty much just taken over his empire because no one's seen the guy anyway,
right?
And is essentially just using his empire as like a cash candy jar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he can do whatever he wants. He's got the voice alternator, but that's also when like they show. You know, when they've got the double Blofelds. And then Bond, the way that he determines which Blofeld is the Blofeld is, he scares the cat.
Well, there's two cats, right? Because then one of them has, like, the diamond.
At first, though, there's only the one cat, and that's why he uses the distraction. And after he kills the Blofeld, which he kills him in a great way, he shoots him. You think he shot him with a gun, but he shot him with the dart gun that he was using for climbing the building. So, like, this bolt hits him, Blofeld in the head. And that's when the other cat comes out with the collar. And you go, oh,
And I think it's got to be mentioned that one of the other main elements of this movie was the diamond satellite, right?
Yeah.
That's going to be used as like a weapon.
Straight up jacked and...
Yeah, and die another day.
Yeah. It's like, it's ridiculous that they...
It's the same thing. I mean, it's the same plot.
Yeah.
If only Blofeld was North Korean or whatever, then...
Yeah.
We'll get to that one in a few hours from now.
Also, Sean Connery steals the moon buggy... And gets in a chase with it. And apparently he bought it after the movie. He owns it. He bought it for like $45,000.
If I'm going to have a Bond prop, this the moon buggy.
That's Connery's pussy wagon.
Because it was his last movie, and he's like, you know what? I want something from it. That's probably the coolest
company
thing.
Car.
My only other thing to bring up about this movie is, like, I would say henchmen fail as far as the Let's Kill Bond, where they take him to a construction site and put him in a pipe.
That was their finish.
They just thought.
Then he's there for like 36 hours until like the construction workers come in the next
Doesn't he just get out? Like I don't even remember.
Yeah, doesn't
No, they bury the pipe.
But you can see that there's guys walking around the pipe and no one notices that there's some guy, or maybe they were just told to bury this dude. And then he's in the pipe, and the electric sparking spinny pipe machine comes out.
Yeah, they're laying this pipe for the express purposes of like Bizarro Johnny Five to come through.
Yeah, it's like wires just spewing sparks.
Yeah, it's like I guess it could be welding, but it's just kind of like flailing. It doesn't seem like it's welding or doing anything.
It's to kill the rats in the pipes.
Yeah,
and for James Bond to ride on.
If that was sent to kill him, it does a horrible job. Because he's really just like, okay, and like climbs over it and just like, boop, and like turns it off. Like really, like no challenge whatsoever.
You know what works? Guns.
I know.
Yeah.
So many movies, like, why would they not put
them? Do you know how expensive guns are?
Right.
Jesus.
The plan is like put him unconscious.
That would cost you
pipe.
Like 12 pipe robots.
Live and let die.
Well, this brings us to Roger Moore's first Bond movie, Live and Let Die.
Love the theme.
Good one.
Great theme. That's my number one.
Theme.
Yeah, I completely agree, dude. It's my number one as well. You really can't go wrong with Paul McCartney and Wings.
Yeah. This
is amazing.
This is the only song, to my knowledge, that gets radio play. Like, still gets radio play.
There's a couple other ones that I can think of.
But. I would say this is the one I hear the most.
This is pretty close to my top, like, lyric, like, one with vocals and lyrics.
Yeah.
I think, personally, Tomorrow Never Dies is actually my favorite, surprisingly. Like, it's just a great song, just as a song, and not even as a Bond song. Like, it's just
It's hard to write a good song, but with the Bond series, you're always going to have good songwriters. So, the tricky part is to take the title of the movie and put that into a good song. Which is why I love Chris Cornell, and I would put his version like on the top of my chart, but it doesn't use the name of the movie in it.
Yeah.
And
Casino Royale is the best casino.
Yeah, exactly. Like even just like you could just like shimmy it in there like The Spy Who Loved Me. Just like slide it in somewhere where it's like just in the lyrics, it's not the name of the song.
Not the chorus.
But to have a song that not only says Live and Let Die, but that's the name of the song, that's like the common refrain, and to have it be such an amazing song is like ridiculous.
What really made that famous was the fame of Paul and Linda McCartney.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, all the other songs have been done by were famous artists, but, you know, as far as like on the fame scale, like if you were to put of all the Bond composers, who is the most famous of all of those composers? You know, I would say Paul McCartney would be the most famous. I don't know who you put it second. Maybe like, you know, Tom Jones is pretty famous.
Or maybe Tina Turner.
Yeah, Tina Turner. Yeah.
Or, you know, I would say Madonna was pretty famous.
Yeah.
But hers is the worst.
She's the worst song.
We'll get to that.
Yeah, we're way ahead of our
But I think, you know, the fact that that's a Paul McCartney song.
Oh, yeah. Well, shit, man. He's in the fucking Beatles. Like, so, yeah.
Who?
Wait. What?
But in addition to Paul McCartney, this is the first Roger Moore movie. I thought he did a great job.
Good start.
Good new Bond. Like, I mean, just compared to, like, George Lazenby, who's trying to do this, like, knockoff, like, Connery. Mm-hmm. Moore really, I think, comes into his own as, like, just a different kind of Bond.
Yeah.
And Connery even said at the time that Roger Moore was the ideal candidate for James Bond. From the beginning, he said that.
Before going into this marathon, I grew up on Connery And then later, you know, I came back into it with, like, Brosnan and stuff. But Moore was sort of the one I had neglected. And I'd only gotten, I'd seen, like, Live and Let Die was the one I had seen. And I'd seen bits and pieces elsewhere. But I had always had this bad rap on Moore that, because I'm so used to Connery, that I'm like, who's this fucking guy? Like, he ain't Sean Connery. He sucks. But, like, in finally sitting down and watching in the marathon, that was, like, one of my biggest opinion changes. Roger Moore was a legitimately good Bond.
Yeah, having had,
in his own right.
Having had no experience with anything prior to Brosnan, like, I, of course, had everybody, when you talk to people about Bond, they're like, oh, well, obviously Connery's the best. Like, there's no doubt. So it kind of set up this idea that going into Moore, I was just setting myself up for disappointment, but I wasn't at all. Like, there's something about Moore that, like, he really made it his own. And because both Connery and Moore were very old, they get to be so old by the end of their runs, but Moore, even, I'd say, better than Connery, is a great Bond, even when he's, like, approaching 60.
Yeah.
Like,
he ages well.
He ages really well.
Because Roger Moore is older in his first film than Sean Connery was in his last film.
Yeah. So it's like Moore brought this, even if he wasn't always as physical as some of the other Bonds, like, he was always had this presence, and I think that was, like, really impressive.
The reason I respect Roger Moore is because of how consistent he is. Like, he gets old. Like, by the last movie, like, him and Moneypenny are like,
yeah,
holy shit. Like,
I think I said the movie should have been called Grumpier Old Spies.
Yeah. They were old. But he is still a kick-ass Bond.
Yeah.
Like, he's probably got grandkids by that point. But, like, yeah, he's still amazing.
What was really interesting to me about Live and Let Die is it's such a change because the bad guys in the movie are these, like, black drug lords.
Mm-hmm.
The whole experience of Bond up until this point has been, you know, these, like, European-suited guys with, like, super plans.
Yeah.
And really, the guys in this movie, like, they're not trying to, like, take over the world or, you know, blow up a nuke. Like, they're just, like, running, like, heroin.
I was surprised that there's not more, or that at the time there wasn't more people that were upset about this being the first one with sort of paranormal stuff going on. Like, supernatural.
I will say that I was upset.
Yeah.
I am upset by several things in this movie. This is not one of my favorite Bonds.
Even though it's one of the better ones. Probably better than Richard's favorite.
It's actually, believe it or not, it's my favorite Roger Moore one. And not to say that it's the best Roger Moore one, because I think there's some better ones. The voodoo stuff, I don't have much of a defense for. Like, it doesn't make a lot of sense. Like, what strikes out to me is, like, Baron Samedi is literally, like a god in that movie.
Yeah.
Like
he is, and he's not.
But what's weird to me is, like, okay, like, Baron Samedi's in the graveyard, and he lifts up magically out of a tomb or whatever, and then, like, Bond shoots him, and he, like, brain splatter.
Well, it's like,
he shatters
like a pot or whatever, and then, but then later, he goes down, and it's like, oh, look, it's like a hokey elevator, and it's fake, but, like,
it doesn't counteract the mysticism element of Baron Samedi.
Like, he shows up, like, three times after he's dead.
He shows up at the end laughing at us.
He's like the final shot of the movie.
When he goes underground, aren't there other people that look like Baron Samedi when he's downstairs?
I don't remember. It's just henchmen at control panels.
There's, like, elevator engineers, and that's about it.
Well, I mean,
floor, sir?
Men's wear.
The ground floor.
I can see that being off-putting and that, like, how is this even possible?
Mm-hmm.
But, like, aside from that, I actually really dig the whole fact that it's like this black culture and it's in, what are they in, like, New Orleans?
Yeah, New Orleans.
It's such a great, like, change of pace to go with these new villains. And
it feels like a more natural transition of trying to do something, like, cultural, like, whereas, like, going to Japan felt like this, oh, we're gonna go to Japan now, like, this felt like, well, there's actually a story taking place here and there's actually something to be dealt with,
like, America, the location is, like, playing a part instead of just being like
and
something
I love
to put on the poster.
The bayou, like, boat chase is
great chase,
incredible.
It's
they're, like, going through fucking weddings, like, driving over land.
Oh my god,
it's so long. It's a long one.
It's really cool.
And the most important member of any of this franchise,
the sheriff,
J.W. Pepper.
J.W. Pepper. the go-to man for comedy.
Greatest Bond character ever.
The bumbling sheriff.
They have, I guess this is, I mean, is this around like Smokey the Bandit time or something? Like
Smoking the Bandit was from 1977, so.
This is even before, pre.
So this was a precursor. This yeah. This probably inspired Smokey.
Amazing. Yeah. But yeah, there's this local sheriff who I guess mixed up in the boat chase.
Yeah.
Who's just so good. He's like got just like skull full
yeah,
of
mouth
in his
full
mouth.
Skull.
Yeah.
Just covered. And the whole time he's just like, dang, oh, what a James Bond. Oh, look out. Like,
he's
just,
a stereotypical redneck sheriff.
Yeah,
very possibly
much. Like, he just takes over the movie for no reason.
I'm going to say he might be the only character I would actually want to hang out with.
I
don't know. You're skipping Dr. Quinn.
Oh yeah. Jane Seymour.
Solitaire.
Makes her
yeah.
She was the youngest woman to play a Bond girl at that 19 point.
19 or
right?
20, yeah.
Looking.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
she was
acting
one of my
bad.
Favorites.
Yeah. Acting very bad.
No, I think the tarot cards did more acting. Would J.W. Pepper be the fool? He would have to be, right, of the tarot cards. Like,
he would be the king. Obviously. I mean, Jane Seymour, like we just mentioned, one of the most attractive Bond girls to me.
Absolutely.
But she brought nothing to the table as far
as
character.
No, she was a terrible actress at the time.
Her character really didn't do anything.
Yeah.
Like, didn't really add much of anything.
And she lost. It has to be mentioned that Bond fucked her psychic powers away.
Yeah,
well, wait,
yeah that's true.
He like got her virginity, right?
Yeah.
Is this the first like cherry popping Bond? Like,
well,
as far as we know.
But this is the first where it's like a plot point where like
yeah.
she
yeah.
loses
oh, yeah.
her virginity.
Yeah, she kept drawing the lover's card and
yeah.
that.
Mm-hmm.
Because
but
he
stacked
the deck.
Deck with lover's cards. But I don't think Bond knew he was gonna steal her psychic
power.
Wait,
and this also has the opening where he uses his magnetic watch to like unzip a woman's.
Yeah,
the underage woman he's hiding in his cupboard.
Oh, well, see, there you go. Yeah,
which is another reason I like Moneypenny. She finds this underage girl who, yeah, looks like 14 in Bond's coat closet of his personal home, and she hides him or she hides, excuse me, hides her for Bond, which is like. Moneypenny is awesome. Like that's something I was not expecting her to do at all.
Yeah, Moneypenny defending statutory rape is pretty sweet.
He
pretty
had
fantastic.
A license to statutory.
God bless you,
Mark.
She's
yeah. part
she's,
of the thing.
She's Bond's best friend, I think.
The other thing I really remember is Yaphet Kotto is the bad guy. It was great.
He was
had
one of my
the,
favorite actors.
He had the weirdest bad guy death.
Mm-hmm.
He got shot with like the blow up bullets.
Oh
and
right,
he
floated to the ceiling
to like as like cartoonishly to the ceiling and just like explode.
Yeah, it was a Gushers commercial.
So I still would like to know the practical applications of a bullet that you shoot into something and then it fills it with air to
and
the point of
it float.
Right.
Maybe it was like a Willy Wonka-esque dinner pill.
This movie also had Rosie Carver. Who is one of my top
Bond chicks. Yes, yes.
Okay. She was maybe the most prevalent black girl in the franchise, but she was beautiful.
Yeah, and she's, know? I believe, the first like African American Bond girl that he like he at least kisses, or I think he has sex with her. But
I'm pretty sure. Yeah,
he just for sure kisses her.
Yeah, he definitely kisses her.
Which
yeah.
really shows a lot. I mean, the whole movie's very. I mean, I could see someone now. Looking down on it as being like racist or something because they're all bad guys and so even but like I feel like at the time is fairly progressive.
Yeah, no, Bond is just equal opportunity misogynist.
Yeah.
I also think that seems to be something of like Roger's forte in the franchise. Like
mm-hmm.
yeah. Roger Moore seems to be down with that more than the other guys are.
Dipping in the chocolate.
Moore's got the jungle fever.
Yeah, because he's got later on.
Yeah, yeah, Grace Jones.
He kind of bookends himself with it.
Yeah.
Anything else about Live and Let Die, guys?
It also has another one of my favorite practical effects. The running
oh,
across
yeah.
a series of alligator heads or crocodile heads.
Yeah, the dude
is
oh,
amazing.
Right.
And
yeah.
the last one actually snaps at the guy, but they're all real, and he's actually walking across a bridge of crocodile heads.
Yeah.
This is what I love about, like, movies will never be the same again. Like, in the days before computers couldn't do anything. Because it's so much better with real, like, they're real. Like,
yeah.
they got some guys like, yeah, I can run over gators, got it. Fucking did it. Like, oh my god, like,
yeah.
fuck ILM. Like,
yeah.
dude, that's amazing. He has a powerful weapon. He charges a million a shot. An assassin, a second. right, well, that brings us up to Moore's second movie, The Man with the Golden Gun.
Yeah,
which,
that was a good one.
You know, at this point in the marathon, I think is when I started to really lose steam.
Yeah.
Like, the next three were, like, kind of a haze for me. I don't know about you guys.
This one is the one that I'd actually seen probably the most. So, so I have a much clearer memory of it than I, for all intents and purposes, should have by that point.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely remember more of it than the next one.
I was pretty loopy around there anyway. Yeah.
But I will certainly not forget the second appearance of J.W. Pepper.
Yeah.
Back in the movie for another movie.
Yeah.
And wait a minute. We were just in Louisiana. Now we're in Thailand. How could he possibly be there? All right. The crazy racist guy is also, like, open-minded about vacation resorts. And he went to Thailand instead of fucking Hawaii.
Even if he gets really pissed at an elephant for reaching in his pocket.
Yeah. Like, he can't do anything in Thailand.
Yeah,
but
all right. How did
I'm gonna
that
go
come about? Like, did J.W. Pepper just go over
I think we decided he won tickets on a radio program.
Yeah,
that's
right.
No. What I mean is more the fact that the creators of the film felt the need to bring him back again.
But not just bring him back, but like in a big way.
With
he participates.
Huge, like, was he just go over, like, did they have audience testing and everyone, like, who was didn't live in like that?
He must have knocked him flat.
It was a theater of me and John. Yeah. Just like A+ check mark.
Live and,
like,
let pepper.
Because he gets into it with Bond again and he's driving around and he's just being JW.
Yeah, he's like a sidekick.
I know you! You're that British fella!
I wouldn't have been upset at all if he had been Roger Moore's sidekick for the entire rest of the
It certainly would have kept me more awake, sure. But aside from that, I think the movie's, like, is it mixed amongst fans? Is this, like, I don't actually have a good idea. Is this one considered a bad one?
I love this one.
I like a lot of aspects of it. The overall plot of it is just a little bit weak. Yeah. But I
like Christopher Lee.
Christopher Lee is amazing. I love the actual golden gun, mm-hmm. how it breaks up into a pen, a cigarette case, and a cigarette lighter. And
his three nipples. He has three nipples.
Oh, right.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, so weird. Third nipple. His character has a pretty cool backstory that he tells Bond casually while they're sitting next to the corpse of the Bond girl, one of the Bond girls. Roger Moore Bond was supposed to meet her there, and he finds out that she's been shot, and Christopher Lee's there. And tells him why he shot her, and goes through this whole long backstory of his character.
And I think we decided that this one is the one that best explains why he doesn't just shoot Bond when he has the chance.
Oh, yeah. Totally.
Because he's more like, he's sportsmanly about it. Because he's like a world famous hitman. But when people come to his island, he's going to play it fair.
Yeah, it's like the most dangerous game.
Yeah,
basically.
Totally. And the little dude is like recruiting people for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Nick Neck is basically hiring assassins to come in.
Which, frankly, I'm sure he's great in the movie, but we got to talking about how that actor, like, killed himself and had this horrible life. So, like, the whole movie was, like, such a bummer. Every time I saw that guy, I was just like, oh, man.
Yeah,
like,
that definitely put a damper on the movie. Was.
His disorder was that had a smaller body, but all of his organs were normal-sized. So he felt like he was in constant pain. And just like had this life of, like, it's not, I wouldn't just say a miserable life, but he was definitely suffering a good portion of it, and ultimately took his own life. But
and actually, the Christopher Lee's part in this, they actually originally wanted Christopher Lee for Dr. No, but
really?
Because he's actually Ian Fleming's cousin,
really,
which I had no idea.
Wow,
but
I did not know.
Yeah, he's Ian Fleming's cousin, so he's like, you got to put Christopher Lee in it.
Maude Adams is in this movie, and she's in, like, a later Bond movie.
Yeah, she is Octopussy.
Yeah.
Right.
But she's in this one, too. Now, did she die in it? I can't...
Yeah,
I'm like...
she's the woman that Christopher Lee had shot. She's essentially, like, Christopher Lee's, like, concubine. Because whenever he does a hit, he has sex right before he does it. The explanation is that it hones the senses.
It makes me fucking tired.
It makes me want to
nap. I could not shoot anybody.
It's really, it makes him, like, the best shot.
I would think if you deprived yourself of sex, you'd be, like, more akin.
Well, like, Raging Bull, like, style, like...
Yeah.
But that was her role, and then, you know, he killed her because, you know, she gave up the information to Bond.
And then the other girl from this one, we have Britt Eklund, who at the time was married to Peter Sellers.
Oh. Mary Goodnight.
Mary Goodnight.
I thought this movie and the next two, to me, had these, like, I could be wrong, but they were very, like, phoned in, just sort of cookie cutter Bond girls that frankly all like looked the same to me.
And definitely. Apparently the character that they used for Mary Goodnight is actually like in the books she's a recurring character. She's like James Bond's secretary or something like that. Really? And in this movie she like kind of plays his assistant a little bit.
He it wasn't like he just met her. As soon as he saw her, he goes, ah, good night, you know, he's aware of her existence.
Also, again, for the Moore series, this has maybe my favorite practical special effect, the friggin' corkscrew jump.
Yeah.
With the bridge.
Yeah. I think, is Pepper in the car? I think he is.
Yeah, he is.
And they're like, oh shit, get him out! And oh, like, are you crazy, Spy? What are you doing?
Otherwise, it wouldn't have worked without him in the car.
Exactly.
Yeah. You gotta balance out
Pepper's
the car.
Pepper screaming actually is what turned the car.
Apparently, that was the first stunt to ever utilize a computer to tell them whether or not they could land the car.
Really? Oh,
and the stunt guy did it correct on his first take, and so he got paid like a crazy bonus.
Oh, good.
Man. Yeah, because they just did it, right?
Yeah, they straight up did it. They built this bridge, and apparently Broccoli had envisioned it for like an earlier movie, but they couldn't do it, and so they patented the corkscrew jump so that people wouldn't use it in movies until they could afford to like set up the ramp and use it in something.
Oh, wow.
So they actually had a patent on corkscrew jumping a car.
Cool.
But what's odd is, like, I guess I'm led to believe this bridge it was ravaged in a hurricane or something. But, like, it's literally,
it's totally gnarled.
Perfectly corkscrew bridge.
Yeah.
Like, that's
there's no justification for it.
Yeah. But
that shit looks awesome.
Yeah. That jump, though, is probably the most fluid jump I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Just how it works. It's just it's
like
just
the car
smooth.
Takes no damage. There was no body work necessary after that jump.
It was a freaking Hot Wheels commercial.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, it was like you see those like play sets where it's like, oh, the car makes the loop-de jump.
Don't forget the thing that clinched the deal. The slide whistle sound effect.
Oh, right.
And by clinch you mean slightly ruined.
But I mean, it goes to show you that like one car jump that's like 5 seconds is so much better than every second of that like car scene in Die Another Day or whatever. Like, I think all those old movies really hold up well because they all have these practical effects that are like, I mean, there's occasionally some laughable like rear screen projection where you're like, yeah, he's on skis, give me a fucking break. But like, for the most part, it looks pretty awesome.
This is going to sound totally wrong, but I kind of miss James Bond beating women. And like
No, that sounds fine.
Because part of the appeal of the character was the un-PC-ness of him like just slapping people around that you're not supposed to slap around.
Right.
In this movie, there's a scene where Roger Moore's in a canoe and it's messed up and this kid's trying to sell him an elephant and pestering him, you need to buy this elephant from me, please buy this elephant. He says, if you can fix this canoe, I'll give you $50,000 or something like that. And get the motor running again. And the kid leans over and he flips a switch so that the motor's getting fuel and it's running again. And the kid's like, all right, buy the elephant for $50,000. And he pushes the kid out of the canoe into the water and just jets off after the bad guy. But I just like love that scene where he's like, you just made a promise to a child and then you broke it. Like, that just because you're in Thailand doesn't mean you're allowed to abuse children.
All right, well, that's going to do it for part 2 of the Cinemarathon Bond podcast. If you made it this far, then I imagine you'll be with us for part 3. So we will see you then.